Good morning, everybody. This is BIO 231, and it is May 5th. And we're going to finish up circulatory system and lymphatic system today. I forget exactly where we left off, but probably somewhere around this figure right here. We're talking about how vessels are named. Most blood vessels are named after the region of the body that they're in. Okay, so for instance, an artery that's in your armpit is going to be called the axillary, right? Okay, the artery in your posterior knee, not just behind your kneecap, but all the way behind your knee joint, that's called the popliteal. All right, so if you remember those body regions, that goes a long way in naming blood vessels. Also, if you remember your bones, that's another good hint to know the names of blood vessels. For instance, in the forearm, the lateral vessel is going to be called the, if it's, yeah, it's going to be the radial artery, and if it's medial, it's going to be the ulnar. All right, so there's not a whole lot of new kind of learning that you have to do for blood vessels, except in a few circumstances. All right, so if we look at the blood vessels here coming off the base of the heart, right, so the best way to study is just to trace these blood vessels, right, and look and see what they turn into. All right, so we're going to start with the aorta. And what ventricle does the aorta come from? Yeah, left ventricle, so it's pumping oxygenated blood. Right at the root of the aorta, there's a valve, and remember what that one's called? Aortic semilunar valves. All right, and right within the cusps of the semilunar valves, the very first branches off the aorta, this is kind of a trick question, the very first branches off the aorta are the coronary arteries, right? Because the blood supply to the heart is part of the systemic circulation, and there is a right and left coronary. Here is the left coronary, here's the right coronary, and then there are branches to those, right? And they're right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve. Then after the valve, this part of the aorta is called the ascending aorta, and then we've got the arch, and then the descending aorta, okay? All right, so the first branches off the arch of the aorta is the brachiocephalic. All right, so notice how I phrased that question. The first branch off the aorta proper is what? The coronary arteries, but the first branch off the arch of the aorta is the brachiocephalic. Okay, brachiocephalic just means that it goes to your arm, brachium, and cephalic means toward the head. So on the right side of the body, this takes blood to the right part of the right side of the head and face, and also over to the right upper appendage. Brachiocephalic bifurcates pretty early into the common carotid and the right subclavian. And that's just named because it goes deep to the clavicle right here. So we call that the subclavian. And then the subclavian turns into the axillary, which then automatically turns into the brachial, right? And then after some bifurcations, you can see the radial and ulnar arteries as well. All right, so those are some of the things you have to know. So what's the first branch? What are the first branches off the aorta? The coronary arteries, right? Don't forget about those coronaries, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, because our upper appendages have a nice bilateral symmetry. The blood supply to them has a nice bilateral symmetry as well. But the branches off the aorta, we only have three. So it is not purely symmetrical in terms of branches off the aorta. So let's take a look at that. All right, so the first branch is brachiocephalic, feeding the right side of the head and face and the right upper appendage. All right, but the next two branches do the job, right? The next two branches combine to do the job of the brachiocephalic. And that is the left common carotid and the left subclavian. So that's just a little anatomic variation right there. Right, we lose that perfect symmetry, but we already notice that the heart is not perfectly symmetrical already. Right, so don't be surprised with that. So then you got the subclavian, axillary, brachial, right, and then you got the radial ulnar arteries. All right, the aorta after the arch turns into the descending aorta, and there are some important divisions of the descending aorta. We call it If it's superior to the diaphragm, then of course that's going to be the thoracic aorta. If it's inferior to the diaphragm, then that's going to be the abdominal aorta. I'm not going to ask you to know any branches off the thoracic division, but you do have to know some branches off the abdominal division. So if we zoom in here, let's take a look at some of these. And the best way to think of abdominal aorta, or the branches off the abdominal aorta, is that they're either going to be paired branches or unpaired branches. So what kinds of arteries are going to come off as paired branches? Okay, which kind of arteries branch off the abdominal aorta in pairs? They're going to organs that you have how many copies of? You got two copies of it. Like you have a right and a left kidney. So you got a right and a left renal artery. You have a right and a left adrenal gland. So you have a right and left adrenal artery. And you have a right and a left gonad. So you have paired branches for all of those organs that we can see right here. All right, so here are the paired renal branches, here are the paired gonadal branches, and there's also going to be some suprarenal arteries or adrenal arteries, probably in another figure in your textbook you can see them. So those are the paired branches, but that also means that there are some other branches coming off the abdominal aorta that go to organs that you don't have two copies of. What are some organs that you only have one version of? Liver, spleen. Did I hear heart? But heart is in the thoracic cavity, not abdominal cavity. Okay, so I'm speaking primarily of abdominal cavity. So you're right, the heart we only have one copy of, but that doesn't really relate to abdominal cavity very well. So we got spleen, liver, stomach, pancreas. Yeah, so you got a lot of different organs, large intestine, small intestine, that you only have one version of, right? So there are unpaired branches that go to these organs. And you only have three origins of three important arteries coming off the aorta as just a single branch. And they are the celiac trunk, right where I have the cursor right here, the celiac trunk, and then the superior mesenteric, and then the inferior mesenteric. So it's easy to tell superior from inferior mesenteric, right, just by looking at the figure. All you have to know then is this celiac trunk right here, which then bifurcates and takes blood to the liver and stomach and spleen and pancreas. Okay, so that's the level that I do want you to know something about these arteries right here. All right, and then after the abdominal region right here, the aorta bifurcates into the common iliacs, and then the common iliacs bifurcate into the internal and external, and then just trace the femoral artery down to popliteal. All right, so I think you're doing pretty good with arteries. Now, most of the veins in your body are named after the arteries that they kind of course with, that they kind of follow along. All right, and that's mostly true, but not true in every circumstance. Where it is not true is in the neck. So let's pay close attention to some of the vasculature in the neck. Ah, here's a really good place to start. So now instead of just an anterior view, we have a nice lateral view, and I see, for instance, this blood vessel right here. What is this blood vessel right here? Aortic arch, okay, and the first branch is the brachiocephalic, and then it bifurcates into the common carotid and the subclavian, right, that then turns into the axillary. All right, so we're not so interested with this anymore. Let's follow the blood supply up to the head. Now, do you think that's important? Absolutely, because you'd never be able to sit up straight and take notes if you didn't have blood going to your head, right? So that's really important. All right, so we have the brain that's inside the cranial vault and a bunch of muscles in your face. All right, so the common carotid is going to bifurcate into an internal and external carotid. So guess where the external carotid goes? Outside the cranial vault to all your facial muscles and skin. And so here we see the external carotid. And the internal carotid right here goes, into feeding your brain inside the cranial vault. At least that's one of the blood vessels. Okay. All right, so this area right here is very important. It's not labeled on your slide, but you should know something about that bifurcation when the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external common carotid, that's called the carotid sinus. because it's kind of a bulb right there. It kind of enlarges a little bit right where I have the cursor. So in your notes and on your figure, write in carotid sinus. And that's a very important anatomical region because there are receptors for blood pressure in that area and some chemoreceptors to measure concentrations of chemicals in your blood. All right, but also, there is a lot of pathology associated with the carotid sinus. And people get vascular disease in that area, and when they get vascular disease in that area, that affects their brain function in some circumstances, especially if it's bilateral on both sides. And that area can be imaged very easily with a fairly cheap instrument. Anybody know what kind of instrument? It's probably one of the most highly imaged areas in the human body. Because people have problems thinking all the time, they get transient ischemic attacks or strokes, and a lot of times it's due to something happening in that carotid sinus right there, and that's imaged with ultrasound. All day long, patients are walking in and out of ultrasound getting images of their neck right there because it's such an important area and produces a lot of pathology. So make sure you label it on your slide, okay? It's really important to know about. All right, so you've got two. You've got a right and left internal carotid, but you have some other blood vessels that feed blood to the brain because, of course, it's very important to get blood to the brain. And let's see where those are. All right, so here we have ascending aorta, brachiocephalic, and instead of going into the carotid, let's go into the subclavian, and the first branch off the subclavian is what we call the vertebral artery. See it right here? And look where it's going. Why do we call that the vertebral artery? It's going through the transverse processes of the cervical vertebrae, and you remember from your bones that there is a hole or a foramen in those transverse processes called the transverse foramina. All right, so here is another important artery that brings blood to the brain. And guess what? Those are the only two blood vessels that bring blood to the brain. The vertebral and the internal carotid. Of course, you have an additional set on the other side of the body. All right, so we got four blood vessels in total going to the brain. Here we see the vertebral arteries. All right, if we look at this slide right here, let's really zoom in. All right, here we see the vertebral arteries. They anastomose. When they go through the cranial vault and at the base of the brain, they anastomose into the basilar artery right here. All right, and then here you can see the two carotid arteries bringing blood to the brain. All right, so you got the two vertebrals via the basilar and the two carotids right here. So your brain is completely dependent on these two vertebrals and two carotids. All right, but now you see like this circle right here. Kind of looks like a roundabout that you have in Long Beach. Okay, blood can go this way, it can go this way, it can come back down over here. All right, so this is sort of like a nerve plexus. What's the job of a nerve plexus? It's a network of nerves that allows alternate pathways for signals to go from your central nervous system to an important effector organ. Okay, so if one nerve gets damaged, signals still can take alternate routes to get to that important effector organ. Well, this is sort of like that because, for instance, if there is a blockage in this carotid artery over here, which would be the left one, blood still can get to this side of the brain because it can come up the vertebrals through the basilar, right, and move through this posterior communicating artery, bypass that blockage, and then still bring nutrient and oxygens to the right side of the brain. All right, so this thing right here is what we call the circle of Willis, and it just allows, it compensates for diseased blood vessels so that you can still get blood everywhere in the brain. All right, so that's really important. So you can have massive reductions in blood flow through a carotid artery, but not suffer a stroke on one side of your brain because the circle of Willis right here will redistribute the blood that's coming in from the vertebrals and the other carotid artery. All right, so blood can take alternate pathways to get to every place in the brain as a result of the circle of Willis. So that's a pretty important anatomical structure, circle of Willis, right at the base of the brain, and you can see that nice pituitary gland right there. Okay. Okay, so veins. So don't forget, how many circulations do you have? You got two, right? What are they? Systemic and pulmonary circulations. And the vena cava, remember you got a superior and inferior vena cava. What circulation do they belong to? Systemic or pulmonary? Vena cava? It's actually systemic, so it's coming back from capillaries everywhere in your body. So are they high in oxygen or high in CO2? High in CO2 because they're the systemic veins. If they were the pulmonary veins, would they be high in oxygen or high in CO2? High in oxygen because they're coming back from the lungs. All right, so let me see if I can find some blood vessels inside the head. Oh yeah, here we go. Okay, so blood vessels that drain blood from the head. Now in the neck, what did we call the artery in the neck? The carotid, right? So it could be the common carotid or the internal external carotid. We don't have carotid veins, we have a jugular vein. All right, so we do change the name for those. All right, so here is the external jugular. Here's the internal jugular, draining blood from the brain and from the face. And in the brain proper, in the brain itself, there aren't many veins as well. There are things that are called sinuses. All right, they're big cavernous spaces. All right, and most of the blood drains back to the superior sagittal sinus. And that flows posteriorly, okay, down to where we call this the junction of the sinuses, because there's a straight sinus coming laterally, right? And then these drain into the transverse sinuses and into this curvy region right here, which is called the sigmoid sinus, and then that's finally drained into the jugular vein. All right, and then, pretty much right around the circle of Willis, here's a cavernous sinus, draining blood from the more anterior parts of the brain. All right, so I guess I mentioned that because in anatomy, you have to be aware of what a sinus means. What can a sinus contain? What kind of sinuses did you know about, learn about? Maxillary sinus. What did that contain? What's inside of a maxillary sinus? Yeah, it contains lymphatic tissue, but it's mostly air. So sinus can contain air. Like right here, this is the sphenoid sinus. There's a hole in the sphenoid bone that contains air. Now, these sinuses right here, like the transverse sinus, what is in the transverse sinus right here? Is it air? It is blood, right? So sinuses are just names for big spaces inside the body, and they can contain various kinds of tissues and materials. You have to know by location what they contain. Okay. All right, so those are the sinuses. I don't think I'm going to go over all of the blood vessels, the veins right here, but I do want to say something about a special kind of circulatory system. And what is the usual kind of circulatory system? What kind of vessel takes blood away from the heart? An artery. Okay, what kind of vessel brings blood back to the heart? A vein. Okay, and what's the last kind of blood vessel in your body? A capillary. What's the function of a capillary? For exchange, yeah, things can move in and out by diffusion, basically, right? And why is exchange allowed in a capillary? Because it's got a very thin endothelium, right? It doesn't have all the other layers that arteries and veins have. Okay, so another question that I have is when you have blood in an artery and it goes back to the heart in a vein, how many capillaries do you usually have between an artery and a vein to make a complete circuit, whether it's the pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation? So for instance, if you got the heart right here, here's an artery, here's a capillary bed right here, nice artistic capillary, and then here you got a vein bringing blood back to the heart. And typically, the typical circulation, whether it's pulmonary or systemic, there's only one capillary bed. That's the usual way that the circulatory system works. All right, so I'm just going to put capillary number one. In a few places in the body, there's a special kind of circulation, right? Instead of having just one capillary bed, right, here is a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart. That's, for instance, what? It's an artery. This feeds a capillary bed, and then it, all those capillaries anastomose into what normally we would call a vein, but then this breaks down into, look at this, another capillary bed. So here is capillary number one, here is capillary number two, and then it goes back to the heart. And this vessel that's between these two capillary beds is called a portal vessel. That's a portal vein or a portal blood vessel. We find this in a couple places in the body. And what the heck is this good for? Can you see that? It's almost not dark, but can you kind of see that? Oh, good. Okay. Well, what can happen in a capillary? Exchange. So there is something that can enter the blood at this point. Okay. Let's just maybe say some toxins. And if this is the usual circulation, where are those toxins going to go? Back to the heart, okay, then to the lungs, and then to the brain, and it could have a deleterious effect on the brain. It could actually hurt the brain, okay? But in this circulation right here, these toxins go into the blood, but they don't go into this general circulation. They go directly to this capillary bed over here. And what can they do with this in this capillary bed right here? Okay, since it's a capillary, exchange can take place, and they can leave. Toxins can leave. All right? And in this particular example, so this portal system, this is a, what we call a portal system, is a special delivery system. It's a door-to-door service, right? So it's special delivery, so these toxins don't go necessarily into the blood. So where do you pick up toxins at? How about in your digestive system? Ooh, Cinco de Mayo. What would be your favorite toxin intoxicant today? Maybe margaritas or something like that, you know, who knows? Okay, digestive system, right? You absorb toxins. You don't want those going directly to the heart or to the brain. So they're delivered to the liver. And one of the jobs of the liver is detoxification of harmful chemicals and compounds. Okay, and then after the liver, it goes back to the general circulation. This kind of circulation, linking the digestive system and the liver, is called the, every time we think of liver, we want to say hepatic or hepato or something like that. Hepatic, all right, and what kind of system is it? Portal system. Hepatic portal system, all right, specifically for detoxifying things that we have in our diet. And all kinds of foods that we eat have nasty things in them. Every time you eat a plant, the plant has evolved to produce toxins so animals don't eat them. But our liver has figured out a way to detoxify some toxins and some kinds of plant materials, right, that protects our body. So that's an important portal system. We don't have many in the body, but a couple others that I think you're going to be interested in eventually would be in the nephron. What organ contains a nephron? Some of you might know before taking this class, but you're right, it's a kidney, has a portal system. And then there's an important portal system between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And we call that the hypothalamic hypophyseal portal system. Hypothalamic means what organ? Hypothalamus. And the hypophysis is just another name for pituitary. And this is a special circulation because the hypothalamus releases hormones then that go directly to the pituitary to control the pituitary gland without being diluted out with the whole circulation. Okay, and so here you have just a nice flow diagram of the hepatic portal system. Okay, and I don't think I'm going to review the fetal circulation because you guys did that in lab a bunch. Okay, but you should probably know, how many structures do you find in the fetus that you don't have in the adult? I got five. I'm thinking five. Okay. Let's start with the easy ones. Well, maybe I should say just something a little bit about the fetal circulation. Let me find a picture of the fetal circulation. Where's that little fetus at right here? This is probably a pretty good one right here. Okay. All right, in the adult, let's not think about the fetus. Let's just think about the adult. How many kinds of circulations do you have in your body? You got two, which are the systemic and the pulmonary. And if you compare or contrast the pulmonary and systemic circulations, tell me something about how they relate to each other, or one way that you can think about them. They're kind of, in a sense, they're opposite to each other, right? And why is that? Because in a systemic artery, can you give me a name of a systemic artery? Systemic artery. Yes, you can. I know you can. Brachiocephalic, which comes off the aorta. Is that carrying oxygenated or deoxygenated blood? Oxygenated blood. But for a pulmonary artery, what kind of blood is it carrying? Deoxygenated. So that's why I mean it's kind of opposite, right? Systemic and pulmonary circulation is opposite. All right. For the fetal circulation, you should think of it as kind of being opposite to the usual systemic circulation. Think of it as like a pulmonary circulation. Because in the fetus, they're not using their lungs. They're really not using their liver. They're using the maternal, right, the mom's lungs to oxygenate blood and the mom's liver for detoxification. All right, so blood really does not need to go to the fetal liver, but it's got to go someplace to pick up oxygen. So here is where there's that special fetal circulation. All right, so the organ in the fetus that is doing the job of the lungs in the adult is called the placenta, right? So blood is going to go to the placenta to do what? Pick up oxygen or to give oxygen away? Pick up oxygen. So the placenta is acting like the lungs in the adult, right? Okay. So you have blood supply going to the placenta. Now this blood is coming from the heart. So here are blood vessels coming from the heart. Are these arteries or veins? They're coming from the heart. They're coming from the heart. So they're arteries, okay? But they're going to the placenta. I know it's a little bit of a mind teaser, but we'll figure it out. All right, so these are arteries because they're coming from the heart. They're going to the placenta to do what? To pick up oxygen. So the blood in these arteries to the placenta is low in oxygen, right? And we call these the umbilical arteries because they're coming from the heart. All right, so they go to the placenta. What happens? There's capillaries in the placenta. What happens? Oxygen goes in. You're right. Exchange happens. Oxygen goes in. All right, so now blood is starting to return to the heart. What do we call a blood vessel returning to the heart? A vein. But this is a special one. This is the umbilical vein coming from the placenta. This is very much like a pulmonary vein. What's the state of blood in a pulmonary vein? Oxygenated. The state of blood in the umbilical vein is oxygenated as well, and that's why it looks nice and bright red colored right here. Okay, so placenta is like the lungs. All right, so here is the umbilical vein, but it doesn't necessarily need to go to the liver because the placenta is helping maintain the fetal blood. All right, so it's diverted away from the liver through this little duct right here. This is called the ductus venosus, and it takes blood that might go to the liver directly to the inferior vena cava. Now, what is the inferior vena cava? Is that an artery or a vein? That's a vein, yeah, so that takes it back to the heart. Where does the superior vena cava empty into in the heart? Right atrium, right? So the blood goes back to the right atrium. Now, from the right atrium, it usually would go into the right ventricle and then into the pulmonary trunk to the lungs, but in the fetus, does blood really need to go to the lungs? No, because it's picked up oxygen already in the placenta. So there is a shortcut blood can take. It can go from the right atrium into the left atrium via this little hole in the interatrial septum, which we call the foramen ovale. Remember, hole is a foramen? And when it does that, it bypasses the lungs. It saves a little energy for the heart because then it doesn't have to pump it to the lungs because there's no sense going to the lungs. There's no oxygen there anyway. And then that oxygenated blood goes into the systemic circulation, helping nourish the fetus. All right, so foramen ovale. Another structure, a little bit of blood does go into the right ventricle and gets pumped into the pulmonary trunk, but you realize it doesn't necessarily have to go to the lungs, so there's another pathway that it can use to circumvent going to the lungs, and it is called the ductus arteriosus. The ductus arteriosus takes blood from the pulmonary artery into the aorta, bypassing the lungs. All right, so those are the structures. I said there were five structures. I think I forgot about the placenta. All right, so you got placenta, umbilical arteries, umbilical vein, ductus venosus, foramen ovale, ductus arteriosus. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, because I forgot about the placenta. All right, don't forget about the placenta. All right, and then when you're born, okay, these structures go away. Okay, so the umbilical arteries just become ligaments, the medial umbilical ligaments, and the umbilical vein becomes the ligamentum teres, which you probably had to know where that is in the adult liver, and the ductus venosus becomes the ligamentum arteriosum, and that foramen ovale closes over in most cases, and it just becomes a depression. What do we call a depression? A fossa, so it's called a fossa ovalis, and a lot of people it doesn't close over, and eventually that's going to damage the heart if it doesn't close, but some people can live until their 40s, maybe even 50s before their heart starts to fail. That's really a long time for a heart defect. Usually we want to take care of that right away. And then the ductus arteriosus becomes the another ligament right here. That's the ligamentum arteriosum. All right, so if you're trying to grasp with how to handle the fetal circulation, what's a good concept to start with? The fetal circulation is similar to what circulation in the adult? The pulmonary circulation. Yeah, it's opposite compared to the usual circulation that you're considering, right? So umbilical veins are low in oxygen. I'm sorry, umbilical arteries are low in oxygen, and the umbilical vein is high in oxygen, just like the pulmonary circulation. All right, so we've got a question about fetal circulation. Okay, I think you'll be able to figure that out. So I'm done with blood. And we got a short chapter next, which is lymphatic system. And lymphatic, before we leave circulation, I have a quick question because I can't remember talking about it. And that is, how many chambers does a heart have? Yeah, you're done with this test already, but I just thought I'd ask you that. All right, four chambers. How many valves does a heart have?
Four
valves, and you got to know the names of valves. Now, do any blood vessels have valves in them? You know what? All veins have valves in them. And I think I bailed out of this chapter just a little bit too fast because I do want to show you something. Okay, about veins. Something that makes veins different than arteries. All right. So here we have small veins anastomosing, joining together to form bigger veins. Okay. And these veins move between muscles in your body, and muscles contract. It will pressurize blood in these veins, and blood is going to have a tendency to squirt back down to the periphery or back up toward the heart. Now, which way should blood flow? Should it pool in your periphery and stagnate, or should it move back to your heart? It should move back to your heart. And the thing that drives it is muscle contraction. That's one of the things that drives blood back to the heart. Okay, but the reason why it goes back is because veins have these valves in them. They close. They almost look like valves inside the heart. Okay, so blood can only move back to the heart in a vein because of these valves. And the valves are made up of the innermost layer of a blood vessel. Does anybody remember what that innermost layer of a blood vessel is? Endothelium. That's right. Just like the valves in the heart are made from endocardium, right? They're the slippery, smooth lining of blood vessels. All right, so people need to have these valves functioning for blood to move back to the heart, but every once in a while, these valves do get diseased, and the veins start to dilate. And when that happens, the edges of the valves can't touch each other, so that means that they can't close anymore. They just kind of flop back and forth. And blood then gets stuck in these veins over here, and that's what produces varicose veins, or something actually maybe a little bit worse, called deep venous thrombosis. Right? So when blood stops flowing, it has a tendency to clot, and that's about the worst place you would like to have a blood clot, is in your circulatory system, because it can produce a pulmonary embolism or heart attacks or strokes. Right? So valve disease in the heart is very dangerous, but valve disease in veins is just as dangerous. All right, so far, how many cardiovascular structures have you learned have valves? I'm sorry. How many cardiovascular structures have valves? Two. And what are those two structures? The heart's got valves, and veins have valves, but arteries don't have valves because there's so much pressure in arteries that that causes the blood to flow away from the heart no matter what. Okay. And what's the function of a valve? Yeah, it keeps blood flowing in the correct direction. It prevents it from flowing backwards, or what we call retrograde. It stops retrograde flow of blood, so it keeps going in the right direction. All right, so I did want to show you that and tell you what layer makes up these valves right here. Okay. All right, so now we can get to lymphatic system. Chapter 20. Ah, good. Okay. So what makes up the lymphatic system? Well, there's lymph. That's a fluid. All right. There are lymphocytes, which are, what are lymphocytes? They're cells. Yeah. Cyte means cell. And they're kind of like a white blood cell. Yep. You're right with that. All right. Let me make this the right size. Ah, that's better. Okay. And then we have lymphatic vessels that carry lymph, as well as lymphocytes. And then you're probably aware that every once in a while, okay, you have these nodes of lymphatic tissue, and we call those lymph nodes. And then we have some organs that make up the lymphatic system, like the tonsils and the spleen and the thymus gland. All right. So those are the structures that we're going to talk about. And the function of those structures, every one of these functions is really important. It's hard to pick which function is the most important. But a function of the lymphatic system, one important function is maintains fluid balance in your body so that you don't swell up. We call that, when you swell up, we call that an edema in a certain part of your body. All right, so what part of your body does exchange take place in? Our capillaries. So when blood flows into a capillary, there's fluid that flows out of it, okay, because remember, there's different kinds of capillaries. There's some capillaries that are very leaky, like fenestrated capillaries. And then here you have a bunch of cells that need oxygen and nutrients, and this fluid flows around all of these cells, and then it returns to the capillary, and some of it gets returned. Okay, so a lot of fluid leaves, flows around these cells, delivering oxygen and nutrients. And then, so this is the proximal part of the capillary, then the distal part, some of that fluid is returned to the blood, all right, and then goes back to the heart so that it can be recirculated. Now, you probably are going to be surprised, how much fluid, does anybody know what the fluid part of your blood is called?
Plasma.
That's called plasma. Yeah, we didn't talk about that much in this class. And then you have the cells that make up blood, like red blood cells and white blood cells, those are what we call formed elements. So plasma can actually leave the circulatory system, or some parts of plasma, especially the watery parts, can leave, right? And as it leaves, what's going to happen to this area here? As the fluid leaves the circulatory system, what happens to the tissues? It kind of swells up, okay? All right? And then when it gets resorbed to a capillary, it shrinks back down. So that's important to realize. Now, how much fluid leaves your blood every day? 30 liters in your body leave every day. Who's got a liter bottle? Anybody have a liter bottle? What's that bottle right there? That's like half a liter, I think. Is that 500 mLs? So 30. That's a liter. Oh, there we got a liter right there. So 30 bottles just like that leave your cardiovascular system every day. So what would happen to you if none of it got resorbed? Yeah, you just blow up like a balloon, right? Okay. The good thing is 27 liters get resorbed at the distal end of the capillary. So most of it gets returned by the capillary, but that leaves 3 of those bottles stuck in your tissue spaces. So after one day, you'd be a little bit swollen, and then the second day, you'd be really swollen. The third day, you'd really start to swell up, right? So there's got to be another way to reclaim that fluid. And that 3 liters that's left over in the tissue spaces gets resorbed by lymphatic vessels, and the lymph vessels then return it to the cardiovascular system so that you don't swell up every day. All right, so that's an important function. Okay. Another important function is that a food that you eat, namely lipids or fat, don't get absorbed by capillaries. They get absorbed by other kinds of capillaries that we call lacteals. And a lacteal is a special lymphatic blood, a lymphatic vessel that absorbs fat. And what part of your system absorbs fat? Your digestive system. Okay, so capillaries in your small intestine do absorb fat. All right, and then another function of the lymphatic system is that it forms part of your immune response. It fights infection, right? And the two parts of that are lymph nodes that filter lymph, and then you have spleen that filters blood, always looking for bacteria and viruses and other things that don't belong. And those organs right there contain lymphocytes that can fight infection. And besides the lymph nodes and spleen, we have lymphatic tissue pretty much all over our body. And that lymphatic tissue that we find in our digestive tract and respiratory tract and urinary tract, reproductive tract, these are what we call mucosa-associated lymphatic tissues, or MALT. And these can also help fight infection. Okay, so why do we call this mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue? What's a mucous membrane? It lines a cavity that's what? Okay, yeah, it has a goblet cell, but it lines a cavity that's what? Open to the outside world. And if that mucosa is open to the outside world, what's in the outside world? Are you there?
Yeah.
Everybody else in the whole world is there, like bacteria, viruses, fungi, right? So those surfaces have to have lymphatic tissue to protect you from all of those other millions of organisms that would like to, right, just live in your body. Okay. All right, so lymphatic vessels. Let's take a look at some. Oh, I don't have them. Lymphatic vessels. Chapter 20. Let's go find chapter 20. Lymphatic vessels. Here's the scheme that I want you to know something about. Okay, so here's your heart. Here's a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart. Here is a capillary. What happens at a capillary? Exchange. You got 30 liters leaving, right? You got some fluid entering, but you still have 3 liters left over in the tissue spaces everywhere in your body, right? And that tissue fluid or extracellular fluid then is taken up by lymphatic vessels, which then return it to the subclavian vein so that you don't swell up, and then also it prevents your cardiovascular system from dehydrating. Okay. So here are some lymphatic capillaries. And notice that a lymphatic capillary is a lot different than a blood vessel capillary because they're just like a little dead end structure, right? It looks like a little finger right here. And there are little flaps that kind of open and close, swallowing up extracellular fluid, and then it gets into this lymphatic vessel. All right, and when a muscle contracts, it pressurizes this area right here, and it squirts the lymph back up to the heart. Now, why can't lymph go backwards in a normal individual? Because, look, even lymphatic lymphatic vessels have valves in them as well, made out of endothelium. All right, so now you know 3 vascular structures that have valves, which is the heart, veins, and lymphatic vessels. Right, have valves in them. Okay, but every time lymph goes back to the heart, since there might be bacteria in there, the lymph has to pass through a lymph node. And the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph and try to identify things that don't belong in your body so that they can be destroyed. So every lymphatic vessel has to pass through at least one lymph node as it goes back to the heart. Okay, so they begin with lymph capillaries, right? Lymph capillaries join together to form vein-like lymph vessels, and lymph vessels contain valves to prevent retrograde flow. And when you ever contract a skeletal muscle, that pressurizes lymph, so it squirts back to the heart. But the lymph vessels contain smooth muscle in the wall that also pressurize the lymph and return lymph to the heart. And whenever you breathe, that also returns lymph back to the heart, because how is it that air rushes inside your lungs? Well, a fluid like air, okay, can move from one spot to another. How can, like, blood move from one part of your body to another? Okay. It's called pressure. Okay, so a fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure, and the job of the heart is to pressurize blood so that it flows from the heart into veins and then back to the heart. Okay, well, air flows into your lungs because you expand your thoracic cavity, reducing the pressure inside your thorax. So if there's low pressure in your thorax and high in the atmosphere, guess which way air is going to go? It's going to go from the air into your lungs, because there's a pressure gradient. And then when you exhale, you squeeze down on your lungs, increasing the pressure to where it's higher than the room, so then air leaves your lungs and goes into the room. So every time you expand your thorax to breathe in, to inhale, the pressure is reduced, right? But not just for air, but for any kind of fluid, other fluids that are in your body. So when you start to inhale, not only does air flow into your thorax, but that also sucks blood back to the heart. That also sucks lymphatic fluid back to the heart as well. Just the fact of expanding your thorax does that. All right, so pressure changes in the thorax is important for returning lymph back to the heart. All right, so let's look at some of the anatomy. Oh, here's a really good picture too. What do we got right here? All right, so here we got an artery. Here we got a vein. Right, we got a lot of tissue fluid that's stuck in the tissue spaces right here, and it enters a lymph capillary and then makes its way back to the heart. So if we zoom in to this tip of a lymph capillary, we can see that it has these flap-like mini valves right here that open and close. When tissues move, we see it has these filaments right here, right, that can open the valve and close the valve. And when the valve opens, it swallows some extracellular fluid, and then it starts to make its way back to the heart. So that's a nice modification of a lymph capillary. All right, so how does it make its way back to the heart? This is a pretty important diagram. This probably is an exam figure right here. Okay, so what do we got right here? From lab, you know what this is. Here's a trachea, right? And then right behind it is the esophagus, and then even behind it a little bit further, here is the thoracic aorta, and then abdominal aorta, okay? All right, so that's just to give you a little reference. And then here is a vein, subclavian vein and a jugular vein right here. And all these other little vessels that we see around on this diagram are the lymphatic vessels. All right, and so what's the job of these lymphatic vessels again? To drain extracellular fluid back to the cardiovascular system. And here you can see where it empties in to the right subclavian, right? And here you can see it emptying into the left subclavian right here. Those are the entry points back to the cardiovascular system. But notice how asymmetrical this figure is. That's sort of interesting, because there's not that nice bilateral symmetry that we see in most organ systems. This right lymphatic duct drains lymph from the right side of the head, the right upper appendage, and the right thorax, and that's it. The left lymphatic duct, right, empties in, and it's draining lymph from the whole left side of the body, as well as the right pelvic region and the right lower appendage. So that's kind of strange how it developed. It's not purely symmetrical. All right, so on this diagram, we can see lymphatic vessels going back to the heart, and before they get back to the heart, they have to pass through at least one lymph node in every particular case, right? And it's the right lymphatic duct that drains all the lymph from this right upper quadrant of the body, right? But on the left side, it's a little bit more complicated. We have these various trunks that are draining major parts of the body that drain into this cisterna chyli right here, which then drains into the thoracic duct, which goes back up all the way above the heart, and then the thoracic duct empties into the left subclavian. All right, so the system is pretty different compared to the right and left sides of the body. The other thing that I notice on this slide is that if I'm looking around, I see that there are some areas where there are high concentrations of lymph nodes. And these are located superficially on the body, so that means that they can be palpated. That means that you can actually feel these lymph nodes. And where do we have these regions? In the axilla, the armpits, you have cervical nodes, and you have inguinal nodes right here. And so sometimes when you get an infection, maybe a physician would like to tell, right, if you just have a local infection, like a pharyngitis, and they might palpate lymph nodes in your cervical region. Is it bilateral, right? And then they might actually palpate these axillary nodes. Did that infection move down to the axillary region or inguinal region, right? And when you have an infection in that part of the body, these nodes become activated, they swell up, right? They start to fight the infection, and as they swell up, they get a little sore as well. You maybe have noticed that, right? So that's what the physician is palpating for the swelling. And he might ask you, oh, does that hurt? Don't doctors always like to do that? Does that hurt? Like if you break a bone, crunch, crunch, does that hurt? Ah, yeah, that hurts. Okay. So this is the general architecture of the lymphatic system. A little bit different on the right and left side of the body. Okay, so these lymph organs contain lymphatic tissue composed of lymphocytes, macrophages. These are kinds of white blood cells that are found in the blood that move out of the blood and into the lymphatic organs like nodes and the spleen. Okay, and maybe some other cells that make up the lymphatic systems. All right, lymphocytes originate from the parts of your body that make blood, namely red bone marrow is responsible for making blood cells, and so it's responsible for making lymphocytes. All right, and then these lymphocytes move into the lymphatic organs. When you have an infection, those microorganisms stimulate lymphocyte cell division. What's another name for saying lymphocyte cell division? What cell division? What's the name for cell division that you learned? Ah, mitosis, that's right. Which means that you have one lymph cell, and after a period of time, you've got two lymph cells. And after another period of time, you've got four, and then you've got eight, right? And then 16, so they grow exponentially. And that's why lymph nodes swell up when they become activated. All right, so these lymphocytes are hanging out in places that we call germinal centers, like lymph nodes and tonsils. And when they recognize a foreign microorganism, we say the immune system gets activated and they start to proliferate through that process that we call mitosis. And as they're proliferating, they figure out ways to kill these microorganisms, right? So that's why lymph nodes swell up. All right, tonsils are lymphatic tissues. When we get into respiratory system, next time I'll show you where the tonsils are. I don't have a good picture in this chapter. All right, but you have three pairs. The palatine, which if you open your mouth and say, ah, these are the ones that you can see in the back of your mouth, in the oral pharynx right there. Those are the palatine tonsils. Then you have a pair that are superior to that. Those are the pharyngeal tonsils. And then you've got some at the base of the tongue, way in the back of the mouth. So the pharyngeal and linguals are really hard to see, but they're there. And they're in those locations to fight infection that's trying to get into your body from your nasal cavity and oral cavity. Every time you breathe, we breathe in bacteria. And these tonsils contain MALT, right? The mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. All right, a lymph node, on the other hand, is not in the oral cavity. These are located along lymphatic vessels. They're small, round structures. They filter lymph. And we looked at some of these superficial regions in your body where they have a tendency to aggregate. And when there's bacteria in the lymph, then that activates the immune system. It causes proliferation of lymphocytes by mitosis, and then they fight that infection. Okay. All right. The other organ is the spleen, and that's located kind of posterior to the stomach and the abdominal cavity. The spleen doesn't filter lymph like a lymph node does. It filters blood. And red blood cells, which make up blood, don't live for a very long period of time. They only live for about 120 days. They don't have a nucleus anymore, so they die. And we don't want those dying and building up in our circulatory system. So one of the jobs of the spleen is to get rid of all those dead and dying red blood cells. And I don't think I told you in here about how many red blood cells die in your body every second. Yeah, millions, about 2 million red blood cells in your body die every second. So your spleen is really busy processing all those dying red blood cells. But that also means that another part of your body has to be building those red blood cells so that you don't become, what's that condition when you run out of blood cells? Anemic. So how many red blood cells does your body have to make every second? It's got to be exactly equal to the number that you lose, which is what? Between 1 and 2 million red blood cells every second. That's amazing. Okay, and where is that part of your body that makes red blood cells? I just mentioned that in passing just a couple of minutes ago. That is red bone marrow, right? The red bone marrow makes red blood cells. Okay, so the red pulp in the spleen filters blood, gets rid of old and damaged red blood cells, but there's another area too that we call white pulp, and that's the part that filters blood of pathogens. And if there's a pathogen in blood, that activates the immune system, and lymphocytes then become activated to fight that infection in the spleen. And then the last job of the spleen is that it's a reservoir for red blood cells. So if you ever start to hemorrhage, cut yourself really bad and lose a lot of blood, the spleen can actually inject into your circulatory system a lot of red blood cells to maintain your cardiovascular system because, does anybody know what the function of a red blood cell is? We didn't talk about that, but it's loaded with a compound called hemoglobin, and hemoglobin is a compound that can carry oxygen everywhere in your body. So that's the job of a red blood cell, to carry oxygen. All right, so if you start to hemorrhage and lose red blood cells, you lose the ability to carry oxygen, but the spleen can add red blood cells to your blood to help compensate for that loss of blood. The bad thing about the spleen, although it's protected pretty well inside the abdominal cavity, it's made out of reticular connective tissue. All right, so can you remember the different kinds of fibers that connective tissue can make? Okay, there are three kinds. Okay, areolar is a kind of connective tissue, but I'm thinking fibers. What kind of cell makes a fiber? What kind of cell makes a fiber? A fibroblast. And a fibroblast can make one of three kinds of fibers. Elastic, reticular, and collagen. Which is the toughest, strongest? Collagen makes up tendons, makes up your dermis, right? So it's really nice and strong. The stretchy one is elastic, not quite as strong as collagen, but when you let it go, it snaps back to where it was, right? Like your ears and things like that. Okay. And the weakest is reticular. It forms a basic framework for some organs, but it can't withstand a lot of force or trauma because those reticular fibers will just rip. So the spleen, since it only has reticular fibers, can be damaged very easily by trauma. If you're in a motorcycle accident, car accident, okay, it's just going to rip. And of course, since it has a lot of blood flowing through it, what does that mean? It's going to rip all those blood vessels and it's going to produce a massive hemorrhage, right? So spleen usually is damaged with a blunt trauma. And here is the bad thing. If you cut your skin, right, if you cut your skin, you can place a suture in skin and it will take really nice because what kind of fibers do you have in your skin? Collagen, right? So it will hold the skin together. But if the spleen is damaged and you place a suture to sew the spleen back together, there's no collagen there, only reticular fibers. Guess what's going to happen?
Skin
The sutures are going to cause even more ripping apart of blood vessels, more hemorrhage. So you can't suture a spleen back together. So the only way to prevent somebody from bleeding to death is to do what? Remove the spleen, a splenectomy. And of course, you try to preserve as much as possible. You only try to remove the part that's bleeding, right? Okay. So you're probably aware of that. Then the last gland right here is the thymus gland that's located in the superior mediastinum. Ooh, where is that? That's right smack in the middle, right underneath your sternum. Okay, right above the heart. That's the mediastinum. And the thymus gland is a place where certain kinds of lymphocytes, namely T lymphocytes, go to mature to fight infection. All right, so I know when you go into microbiology, I think you're going to talk a lot about the immune system. Just try to remember that we talked about lymphocytes and how important the lymphatic system was, but then you'll have to learn about different kinds of lymphocytes as well. All right, so that's the lymphatic system, which does what? Returns fluid to the cardiovascular system that gets left in tissue spaces, right? It helps fight infection, and then when we get to the digestive system, we're going to see how it helps absorb fats that are in our diet. Okay. So that's it for lymphatic. So next time, what do we got to do next time? Are we going to do like digestive system or what? Respiratory. All right, maybe respiratory and digestive system next time. So I hope you're still doing your homework. Okay, doing that pre-lecture reading assignment. That's really helpful.
I do know you and my lab instructor.
Okay.